Jazz, 91.9 FM and WCLK.com. Jamal Ahmed with the Soul of Jazz. That's music coming from the legendary, one of my faves, the man, George Duke, from his latest LP, Deja Vu. And he called that one a melody, one of our faves around here at Jazz 91.9 WCLK. And of course, Mr. George Duke will be in town for our 39th anniversary benefit concert on Wednesday, April the 3rd at 7:30 p.m. at the Cobb Energy Performing Arts Center. And I'm so blessed right now because I actually have the legendary, when I say he's my number one in the world of jazz, jazz fusion, jazz funk, whatever you want to call, samba jazz, whatever you want to call it, he is the number one, and I have him on the line, Mr. George Duke. How you doing there, sir?
I'm doing great.
It's an honor to have you.
My pleasure.
Yes, yes. So let me get in your head, Mr. Duke. Now, where are you from again?
I'm actually from the Bay Area.
You're from the Bay Area?
Yeah, the San Francisco Bay Area.
Okay. Now, you know, I had Sheila E. on the air probably about a month or two ago. Well, actually, I would say about 2 months ago. And we were talking about her growing up in the Bay. And I said, there's something in the water in the Bay Area that just makes everyone free and kind of come together more. What is it about that region of the country that just brings people together and brings something out of people?
That's a good question. That's a good question. I don't know what it is, but it does seem like, but that particular era especially, coming out of that area, there was a lot of special music, not only on the East Bay, but on the San Francisco side, you know. So there was a lot of Latin music, there was the rock and roll, there was a thing with Jimi Hendrix, the Sly and the Family Stone, all of that, all different genres of music. The whole jazz scene was very strong. I don't know. It was just, just the environment, you know. It was just very free. Mm. And once the hippie thing happened in the 60s, you know, that kind of freed people up.
Yeah. You know, and it's interesting, and I'm not trying to name drop here, but I actually had a chance to speak with Al Jarreau, too, last year. And we talked about that scene and how important it was to all of you guys. And I want to ask you, you know, I remember during that era, two individuals who you played with in the 60s, one being Cannonball. And the other being Frank Zappa. Now, which one came first?
Actually, Frank Zappa came first.
So you did Zappa.
I had met Cannon actually when I was working with Jarreau at this little club in San Francisco, because Cannon used to come down and hang, you know, because it was a neighborhood club. So when he got through playing at one of the other clubs, he would come hang at our place because, you know, that's where the action was, where the ladies hung out. It was a neighborhood place, and we were playing. Matter of fact, he told me I sounded like a bad Ramsey Lewis at that time. But then he eventually hired me for the gig. But I got the gig with Zappa first through playing with Jean-Luc Ponty. We did an album called King Kong, and Frank got introduced to my playing and for some reason asked me to join the band. But a year later, I got a call from Cannonball. So that happened in 71. It was in the 70s.
Got you.
I'm not that old.
Well, you know, I want to talk about Zappa because I'm sure that energy, because, you know, you're one of the few jazz musicians that I know. I mean, and there are a few, but I can really only count them on one hand, who played with some serious, like, over-the-top rock guys. And Frank Zappa was, I mean, not only just a over-the-top rock guy, but he really created his own rules. What did you learn from that
Absolutely.
Camp?
Oh, man, I learned so much from working with Frank. I mean, he opened up my mind to the world of music, actually sat me down and taught me about, you know, that I needed to open up my mind to the world of music, and that I was being a little too narrow in terms of what I like to play and what I like, that I should expose myself to other forms of music and make myself aware of it and use it if I feel like it. So he was the first one to get me to sing, the first one to get me to play synthesizers, the first one to allow me the freedom to use humor in my music. You know, I hadn't thought about any of this, but I was a serious straight-laced jazz cat. That's all I knew, you know. But then when I got with Frank, all those barriers broke down. And he had me playing doo-wop, you know. And so this was like a whole other world for me. And Cannon was the same way. I call him Cannon. You know, Cannon was the same way in a different way. But it very, very much the same thing. Very strong. And during my formative years, hey, man, I couldn't have asked for two greater heroes.
No, I mean, it seems like they really set the stage for you to go out on your own. And we were talking earlier on the phone about those classic recordings that you did for the MPS record label out of Germany. And those things really are in a class of their own. And when you talk about humor, we were talking about the track For Love I Come, which the man Thundercat just recently remade. And I can always remember like the little breakdowns when you're kind of talking like you're drunk. And it's just it was just so hilarious. And it showed a whimsical side of you. Talk about those records that you did for the seminal MPS record label.
You know, I was very fortunate and blessed to be able to have those guys in my young years when I was learning how to play. They were the first company, which was Sabo, was the first company I recorded for. And I must have done maybe 7-8 albums for them before I did a recording in the United States. And that allowed me to get my act together, you know, and figure out who I was. So those records like Faces and Reflection, Feel, The Aura Will Prevail, those kind of records that you got to be old enough to,
to know. I know them.
they were all records where I was searching,
yeah,
you know, and trying to find out, you know, who am I? And, of course, I had the fortune of being able to work with Frank and Zappa and Cannonball during that time, so it really helped, you know.
And you also work with, but you know, I'll get to her in a little while, but you did some work with, I guess when you got deeper into the 70s, that's when funk really started taking a hold of pop music. Mm-hmm. And you really caught the funk bug, and you're one of the progenitors of that classic kind of jazz funk fusion era of the late 70s. But you had a partner in crime with Stanley Clarke. How did you two meet and start working together?
Well, Stanley, I met Stanley when he was playing with Chick Corea, and I was with Cannon, Cannonball, and we did some dates together, and we became friends. He's a great player, and he loved, just like me, a very diverse order of music. So we kind of got together. I started playing on his albums. He started playing on mine, and eventually we hooked up and started making albums together. You know, and it was really as simple as that. We're still touring together now, and he's like the younger brother I never had. And the rest is history, really.
Yeah, yeah. It's not much you can really say when it's just a natural friendship.
Yeah. He's a cool brother, man, and knows how to play that bass.
He defined, you know, bass playing in his era. And you know, when I listen to your music, because you work with one of my favorite Brazilian vocalists of all times, and really one of my favorite vocalists, Flor Purim, who. It just has a voice that no one else has. She can do things with her voice that I've never heard anyone do. But you know, did a lot of kind of samba things on your records, and you even did a whole record dedicated to the music of Brazil, a Brazilian love affair. When did you catch that Brazilian bug, and what is it about Brazilian music that makes you gravitate towards it?
You know what? It's the perfect combination of melody and rhythm, as far as I'm concerned, and culture. Because I always felt that the culture was what you could see it in the music, you know. And I first got introduced to it back in the 60s when I heard Sergio Mendes in Brazil, 65, you know, when they were playing in the Bay Area. And eventually I said, man, I don't, you know, I didn't know what Brazilian music was, and that was only a particular kind of thing. But I decided one day that I had to investigate this a little further, and Cannonball helped that by actually taking us to Brazil. And I had a chance to meet Milton Nascimento, and I bought every Brazilian record I could find. And I said, one day I'm going to go back there, and I'm going to make an album with Brazilian musicians. And I had the chance to do that around 1980 or so after the funk records had come out. I convinced Epic Records to allow me to go down there. They said, I'll get a kid some money, let him go down to Brazil. And so after Dookie Stick and Reach For It happened, I went down with my band and attempted to make a hybrid record. And they just thought it was going to be a record that just come out and a week later be gone. But I'm telling you, for some reason, that record has stuck around, and it's still one of my most beloved records and one of my favorites. Actually.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, Love Reborn, that take that you had of Love Reborn is just... I mean, that's love making music right there. That is some beautiful music, man. That that is still untouched to this day. Now, I want to kind of jump because you did so many things. And if you're just tuning in, we're speaking with the legendary George Duke, who will be performing for our 39th anniversary benefit concert here at Jazz 91.9 WCLK on Wednesday, April the 3rd at the Cobb Energy Center. And we'll get to that. But during all the time that you were doing so many things, I mean, you had Sweet Baby, which was probably one of your biggest records, mm-hmm. That came out when? Was that 1982?
It was 1980.
That was 80. Okay.
Right
okay.
around there. And that was a lot of stuff at one time.
Yeah, because that was around the same time as A Brazilian Love Affair.
Yes. Yeah. Right around there, 81, something like that.
Did you sleep any time doing that air?
No, not much. So, I was in Atlanta a lot, too.
Oh, wow. Well, I know you got stories. We'll talk about that when you get to Atlanta. But but Sweet Baby, huge pop hit. I mean, it took you to places that I assume that you never dreamed of being. What type of impact did that song have on your career?
Well, it's quite tremendous. I mean, for me and Stanley. And it was a song that was not intended to be on the album in the beginning because it was so different than anything else on the record. And it was just something that just before we went in, I mean, the day before we went in the studio, I played this for Stanley in my hotel room because I had a Fender Rhodes in the room and we were still working on some music. And I had this little idea, and it came really quickly. And I played it for Stan, and he said, "Man, I love it. Let's record it." Because I was kind of afraid to play it for him.
Mm.
But I said, "Man, he's not gonna like this." And so we wound up doing it, and you know, a take later, that was the biggest hit we had.
Wow! Yeah,
we had to convince the record company to release it. They were not interested.
Oh, and why do you think they weren't?
Well, because we were considered jazz funk artists, and that was not a jazz funk record.
Right. Right, right. But I'm glad they did it, but I'm sure they're very excited that they put it out.
Oh, yeah. They eventually came in and brought it home. But we had to actually go out on our own and pretty much promote it by ourselves. And once they found out that they had some traction, they came on board and brought it home.
Right, right, right. Well, you know, when that record came out, I was still, you know, age-wise, I was still in the single digits. So I really did.
Oh, my God.
I still couldn't grasp the importance of that record. But, you know, there were two ways that I got introduced to your music. Being part of the hip-hop generation, I was hip to your music through samples. And also, I remember seeing a performance that you and Stanley Clarke did on the Arsenio Hall show. I think this is like 1990, 91. It was the very first time that anyone saw, I think it was Rashawn Patterson, who was singing with you guys. And I think, I forget the name of the hip-hop group that was out of Los Angeles, and you featured that MC. I can't remember right now. Compton's Most Wanted or something like that. It was one of those big bands that came out of the West Coast. But it was very interesting because here are two jazz musicians with a soul vocalist and a hip-hop artist playing on the Arsenio Hall show. You were way ahead of your time. Talk about hip-hop culture and what it meant to you at that time.
Well, we were basically trying to combine some elements. You know, obviously trying to be aware of what was working at the time. You know, musicians have to constantly reinvent themselves. They can't just keep doing the same thing over and over and over again. I mean, even Miles Davis, if he played There Is No Greater Love, which was a standard back in the 50s, he certainly was not going to play it the same way in the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so, you know, and you have to combine other younger musicians with what you do. And that was an attempt to do that. You know, and we said we needed to have at least a couple of songs on the record which represented what was happening then.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so that was the deal, and I thought it was relevant and important, you know, that we combine those elements.
Yeah, well, it affected me because not only was it a powerful fusion of different styles, but the message, you guys were talking about the mighty General Hannibal from Carthage,
right.
Which was something that you didn't hear jazz musicians talking about at the time. It was just something that was amazing. And I guess the final questions I have for you are this. You know, during that time, there was a lot of push and pull, and I've been working at this radio station since 1994, and I've always seen that push and pull between the fusion contemporary jazz funk cats and the straight ahead kind of swing bop cats, and it's yeah. it's always that very interesting dynamic, and I always thought it was silly because at the end of the day, everything comes from the same source. And so I wanted to get your take on that because I've heard you play straight ahead and you can swing with the best of them, but what is your take on all that?
Well, yeah, I agree with you, and I think you already answered it. Yeah, it all comes from the same place, you know. Theory, if at its best, it comes from the same place. You know, and it all has the origins in the same place for sure. You know, it's a shame that that had to happen, but you know, it's funny. It's almost like, you know, that Spike Lee movie where you have the thing between the light-skinned brothers and the dark-skinned brothers. Mm-hmm. It's almost the same thing. It's almost like, okay, the real jazz guys are dark-skinned brothers, and you light-skinned brothers, you know, you're not doing the real thing. You know, it's almost synonymous to that. For me, I agree what you just said. I mean, it all comes from the same place. It's all legitimate. That look, I can play doo-wop and be as happy as I can Stravinsky.
Right.
For me, because my palette is that broad and that colorful and that diverse. And that's what I love. But some people, they like one thing and they stay with that one thing. You know, some people get involved with the 60s and dress that way, and that's the way they stay for the rest of their life. I can respect that and understand that, but don't expect me to do that. You know, because I want to see what's out there. I want to travel. I don't want to just stay in L.A. I want to go to Europe.
Yeah.
I want to go to Japan. I'm just making an analogy there where I like different tastes. I don't eat spaghetti every day. I love spaghetti, but I want some gumbo every now and then.
Right, right.
So I need to change up and do different things. And I think there's nothing wrong with that. It's legitimate as long as you're honest about what you do and you're presenting it honestly. And doing it well, hey, there's nothing wrong with it.
Right, and I mean, hey, man, you even cut the fro from the 70s, so you changed up, man. It's like, you know, you have to do something different, and I always appreciated that about you. And even like this latest record that you had, Deja Vu, which came out back in 2010, and we're still playing this thing. What I loved about this record is it was really your old, in my opinion at least, your old to that classic sound, but in the 21st century.
Right. Well, you hear my new one. I'm working on a new one now, and as a matter of fact, we're mixing it right now. It'll be out sometime in June, and it's really, really probably the best effort I've done in many, many years.
Mm.
I really put my foot in this one.
Mm. Well, you know, I know that we're going to see something phenomenal on Wednesday, April the 3rd, here at the Cobb Energy Center. For our 39th anniversary benefit concert. But Mr. George Duke, if you could just tell people, what can they expect? Because I've seen you live at least 3 or 4 times, and every time it's a different experience. But what can people expect from you when you come to the ATL?
Well, when they come to the Cobb Center, if for some reason the roof is gone, they'll understand that the Duke tore the roof off the sucker. Hello.
Literally.
It became a convertible.
Oh man, that's I can't even talk after that.
The Cobb convertible.
I love it. That's what's going to happen on Wednesday, April the 3rd, y'all. You guys are going to actually be looking at the stars at the end of that concert when George Duke finishes. And we thank you so much, sir. We know you got to run. But thank you so much for all that you've done for music. And God bless you on all your future endeavors. And again, we look forward to seeing you on Wednesday, April the 3rd. And can we get out of here with a little bit of funk? And you know, I would love to hear you introduce this classic record, because it's the jam. Reach for it.
Oh, reach for it. Well, you know, you got to keep on reaching for things. So, that's what I want you to do, baby. Keep on reaching for it.
Well, thank you so much.
Because Dick is aware of all. Each and every one of y'all. I'm done.
Thank you so much, George Duke.
Okay.
Have a great one.
You too. Ciao. Party, baby. Because the funk show will make you stay. Say what? Yeah. And you let the funk hit your eye. You're gonna turn into a spy.